Welcome to another episode of the Religious Studies Project, broadcast to you from the Religious Studies Project offices in the Wash Bar on the Mound in Edinburgh. My name is Christopher Conter, and I'm with
David Robertson. And it's a cold, bright morning in November here. What's the interview we got today? As though I don't know.
The interview that we've got today is, first of all, presented in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, who are awesome, as we are every week. But this week's also presented in association with the University of Chester, because this is what we did a few weeks ago. We went down, we did a workshop, and then we recorded an interview at a roundtable. And this interview was one that you did, actually, with Alana Vincent on religion and literature. Take it away.
Today, the Religious Studies Project is speaking to Dr. Alana Vincent, a lecturer in Jewish Studies at the University of Chester. She is interested generally in the interdisciplinary study of religion, the arts, theology. She studied Atlanta, her undergraduate, and her PhD was carried out in Glasgow, but we are now here in Chester, where we are doing our workshop and live podcasting today. So first of all, welcome to the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you.
We're going to talk today about religion and literature. Now, religion, contested term, literature, possibly a little bit clearer in meaning, but for me, the big question is the "and" there. What does the "and" mean? Maybe you can set out what the question religion and literature is.
Well, you neatly spiked my planned rejoinder, which was going to be, I think, the interesting term there is really literature, and how we construct literature within the framework of religious studies. When we're talking about literature within religious studies, when we're talking about that "and," we could be talking about a number of different things. Literature as sacred text, first and foremost. There's a long tradition, which has been problematized over the last 100 years, of religious traditions having at their core some sort of sacred text, which is read and reread and reinterpreted within a community. Also, some of those reinterpretations can take on a literary character of their own. Speaking from within Jewish studies, we have the heritage of Midrash, the going back to scripture and filling in the blanks that are left in the narrative, oftentimes in very creative ways, and that feeds into actually quite a bit of later, even contemporary literature. Micheline Wander would be a great example of a still working author who is writing precisely in that tradition. Of course, we have the heritage of applying techniques from the study of literature, fictional literature, to the study of sacred text. And that has shaped most of biblical studies in the last 100 or 200 years.
So form criticism,
form criticism, historical criticism, etc. That's not really what we mean when we're saying we're doing literature and religion, though. I mean, that's come so far into the space of religious studies. It's a part of the discipline. We don't need to make that interdisciplinary bridge. So, more interdisciplinarily, that's a really horrible, clunky adverb.
We know what you mean, though, yeah.
We'll let that go. And we can look at literature as an artifact. Something that tells us something about the community that produced it. We can do that in historical terms. My last monograph has an entire chapter that's dedicated to Anne of Green Gables, of all things, because it's telling me, I'm reading it to find out something about the way the work of mourning in the First World War was carried out in rural, small-town Canada, and Anne of Green Gables was received, at the time it was written, as an exceedingly realistic portrayal of that community. It was reviewed as the most realist of all realist novels that were written at the time. So the religious community portrayed there, we can say, was recognizable to the audience that consumed it. Therefore, it's doing a certain historical job.
Yeah, so we're essentially reading the text there as a source for how religion was viewed in certain
times. It can also, Ein literature also can provide a space for communities to carry out intra-communal debates. Good examples of that would be Naomi Alderman's Disobedience, which is about the issue of sexuality in the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, and it's being consumed by non-Jewish readers. But it's speaking into a very, very particular debate within the Jewish community, and we as scholars can look at what's being said there and monitor it in a way that is perhaps a bit more accessible than going to Golders Green with a microphone and trying to get people to talk about whether they feel like being Orthodox Jews forces them to remain in the closet.
And there is a great deal of literature, fiction seems to be concerned with these kind of religious ideas. Particularly contemporary novelists, I think there's often a real undercurrent of questions about religious identity. Is there something about the particular form of literature that lends itself to people working out these kind of questions for themselves, do you think?
Well, yes. Literature is a space of imagination. It's a space of play. It's a space of possibility. It's a space of exploration. You can be much more free as a writer, of fiction in positing ideas and thinking through them, thinking about, what the after effects are. Literature is not normally an argument. Mm-hmm. You're not taking a position and committing to it for all time and forevermore. You're positing what if.
You've got the prominence of religious themes in science fiction. I think it makes that parallel very clear, that it is what if, and positing these kind of ideas.
And science fiction and fantasy are some of my favourite genres to work with precisely because of that. You can test sometimes really contentious ideas at their, almost at their logical extreme. And at the same time, though, literature individualizes, it humanizes, it invites the reader to consider a viewpoint, a worldview, a communal space from a very intimate vantage point. A misleadingly intimate vantage point. And that's one of the big methodological cautions that we have to throw up when we're dealing with literature, because the voice of the author is an authorial voice. It's not a first, it's not an interview. The narrator is not the author, no matter how closely related they might be. And what is being presented is being constructed very carefully and very deliberately, and you have all those know, great literary studies questions about narrative reliability, about, you know, viewpoint, about what's going on just off the page that you aren't being allowed to see. These are also questions that are useful to transfer into other kinds of study, by the way, and you know, studying literature does make us more conscious of the ways in which other sorts of narratives are also always already constructed.
I wondered, you mentioned earlier on about this idea of, you know, the novel as artifact. So I wanted to ask you, what do you see as the relationship between what you do and the sort of material study of religion, which is so popular at the moment in the field? There seems obvious connections, but some striking differences as well.
I think you just nicely answered and summed up your own question. There are obvious connections and some striking differences. You know, yes, literature does some of the same things that we aim at when we're looking at material. It's dislocating religion from the site of, you know, hierarchy, dogma, ritual, and trying to move into a place of accessing religion as lived everyday experience. It's a good goal. Now, that being said, there's a host of questions that you have to ask about you know, serious material artifact studies that you wouldn't really ask about literature. You might ask them about books. But you wouldn't put, you know, what is this story? Who produced it? Who did they produce it for? How was it used in the community? But you're talking about story. You're talking about what's in the book. You're not talking about the book that gets picked up and put down and moved around and treated in a certain way. That's the material question. The story question is the literature question.
I mean, it's almost like an artifact that's secondhand, isn't it? Rather than, you know, like, you know, say a Catholic votive or something has been created by one person. But the narrative in a novel is sort of created by one person, but it's pretending to have been created by this by the characters who inhabit it, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily. You have... that depends on the narrative viewpoint. You know, a nameless, faceless, limited, omniscient narrative you tend to assume is created directly by the author, whereas a first-person narrative you assume is being told by a character created by the author. In both cases, though, you could fairly say that meaning is actually... You know, there's a place for what I would call reader response criticism. You know, the idea that meaning is not created by the person who makes the story or the votive and then transmitted unproblematically to the consumer or user thereof. You have the initial object or story in which you know, there is some latent meaning and the reader and the user imbues it with a further sense of meaningfulness through their interaction with it. And the meaning that is constructed between reader and text is not necessarily the meaning that is intended between author and text.
It relies on the symbolic content of the novel or of the narrative, say, let's say that way, is dependent on the on a larger cultural matrix of meaning, really, isn't it?
And therefore, it is always in flux.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's constructed and reconstructed every time you go back to it.
Let's step back a little bit from the theoretical kind of considerations of this approach and take a look at a piece of your research that you've been, something you've been working on recently that can give us an example.
I spent the summer working on a paper on Golememe in contemporary literature. Now, the golem is a Jewish folktale. It's a creature which is constructed by a human, and it has, it's animate, it can move, it can do things. It can't talk normally, and it doesn't have a soul. There's obvious parallels between the golem and the Frankenstein legend, although part of what I point out in this paper is the chances of one having been the chances of Frankenstein having been based on golem mythos are really slim, because golem tales don't actually enter into English until the early 20th century. They're pretty popular in German through the 19th century. But even then, not quite as popular at the time Shelley was actually writing. And this is a perfect example of literature as that space of imaginative play. Because what you find in especially latter 20th century English literature that's drawing on the golem mythos is it's asking questions about the nature of the human. And it's positing, you know, this not quite finished, not quite complete, almost human, you know, as a contrast to, you know, and as a way of troubling what we assume, you know, human being to comprise. It's asking questions, well, what, you know, is a golem self-aware? You know, at what point does that self-awareness obligate us to honor its agency? This is not dissimilar from, you know, the host of android and artificial intelligence stories that we have also floating around in the last several decades. I'm interested in the golem because it's a particularly Jewish take on that issue, and, well, my job title does kind of obligate me to pay a little bit of attention to that particularism. But also because it's a very, very old folktale. You know, we find Golememe in the Talmud, you know, and we find some textual evidence of the idea of this sub-created creature existing, going back to somewhere, you know, between 200 BC and 200 C, depending on which system of manuscript dating you're inclined to believe. And what I've found remarkable is the consistency with which the golem has been used in precisely this way as a boundary question, as a test case for, you know, where are we drawing that line between a form of being that we are in some regard morally and ethically obligated to, and a disposable automaton, which is this is interesting because we have then non-literary texts. We have a whole heritage of actually legal rulings that are doing almost the same sort of job that we now expect to find mostly just in the pages of fiction. There is a broader point to be drawn out there about the history of literature and imagination and when we started compartmentalizing our world into fictive and non-fictive texts, because this textual heritage actually does go back past the point where that would have been a meaningful distinction.
Mm-hmm. And of course, when there are certain new religious phenomena, shall we call them, Discordianism, Jediism, in various forms, which play with that boundary, and that's perhaps why they unsettle people quite so much. That they do disturb our perceived line, perhaps.
They do, and yet that sense of disquiet in itself I find puzzling and a bit disquieting. What was the leitmotif in Doctor Who over the last few seasons? We're all just stories in the end.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, the Raggedy Doctor and all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah. The more I work with literary texts, the less happy I am with that taken for granted barrier. You have narratives, you have meaning, you construct meaning through narratives.
Yeah.
And I'm not certain that the question of whether some narratives are real and some aren't is a helpful question for those of us who are interested in studying how meaning is being constructed through narratives.
Yeah. But a lot of religious identity, however, is constructed through narratives which the individual creates. It seems like seems that it's a matter of intentionality. Is that right? Would that make sense?
Yeah, and to be fair, I can understand that it would matter very deeply to some individuals who construct their identity around a particular set of narratives, that those narratives be, if not absolutely real and true with big Teutonic capital letters at the beginning of each word, then at least not something that causes them to feel foolish. Which is where we get to that whole slew of cautions about sensitivity in studying communities. And those are perfectly fair and reasonable concerns. But
Wicca is quite a good example of that recently.
Wicca's a great example, yeah. What I find myself falling back on in the classroom is the adage that, a person's belief is real. Mm-hmm. A person's belief is always real, regardless of what the thing they are believing in is or isn't.
Yeah.
Which is a shorter, pithier way of saying the meaning is constructed regardless.
Yeah. We seem to be getting to what we're wanting to talk about in the round table.
Yeah.
So I think that what we'll do is we'll wrap this up now. I'll say thank you for taking part in the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you for having patience with me.
Absolutely, great. And doubly thank you for allowing yourself to be filmed, which has been nerve-wracking for me as well. And we
feel so much better being told that, by the way.
And we'll move on to the roundtable section. Thank you.
Great.
Well, that was a fantastic experience, David. That we've had live studio audiences in the past for our Christmas specials, but that was the first live interview, and I think you and Alana did a very good job.
Yes, it was an interesting experience. It worked quite well. We wrapped it up perhaps a little sooner than we often will with an interview, but with good reason, because I didn't want to get into too many of the deeper kind of questions or the more theoretical kind of questions, because we were about to sit down and record a roundtable where we brought in a number of other people, which you're going to hear the fruits of on Wednesday. We had our own Ethan Quillen, we had Don Llewellyn from Chester, we had
Wendy Dossett, Elaine Graham, and Alana Vincent.
I want to make sure I didn't miss anybody.
That's
out there.
Quite all right.
So that the topic, we broadened the topic out from just religion and literature out into ideas of narrative reflexivity. So instead of narrative in a very limited sense, we open it right up into a broader sense of how it relates to method and theory.
Yeah, and the place of the author and authors in as much as writing culture and that sort of thing. So as scholars, are we authors writing texts and narratives and producing literature and that sort of thing?
Yeah, and the importance of these kind of questions in using ethnographic sources as well was quite important. You know, are we right to draw a strict delineation between entire literary kind of sources and pure objective sources?
You can't see the scare quotes there, folks.
Yeah, of course, yes.
You could hear it in the derision in the
voice. I can create scare quotes in the mind of the listener using my voice.
That's a rare talent.
It is. Much practice. That's the training that we've had as broadcasters and journalists.
Absolutely. So yeah, tune in for that later in the week.
Indeed.
What happened last weekend was the SSSR conference. We already flagged up to you that we were going to have an RSP panel there, but we've definitely got another interview coming from the SSSR conference that Dusty Hosley recorded with Wade Clark Roof, which is quite an exciting interview, particularly in the sort of field of spirituality in quotes there. Roof is a big name, so we're looking forward to that. Next week's an interview that I recorded, another interview in Belfast, this time in a church. I think it's probably the first interview that recorded in a church, on the topic of the post-secular.
What is the post-secular?
You'll just have to listen next week and find out, David. But I think the conclusion might somewhat, blow the question out of the water, perhaps.
Anytime we have these categories with the post-something, it sets my heckles up. You know, the post-modern, the post-structuralist.
Post-colonial. Yes, we're not colonial anymore, folks.
No! Entirely post that.
Yeah.
It often seems to be generally a slightly more nuanced version of the thing that it's supposedly post.
Yeah.
Post rock. Any Mogwai fans listening at the moment will be utterly confused as to what I'm talking about, as am I. What we did have last month, as well as we've talked about last week, but last month was the busiest month on the Religious Studies project since the project began, all the way back there in January 2012.
Absolutely, yes. So there were well over, I'm going to say it was over 12,500 hits on the website, which for a 31-day period is not bad.
For a niche little interest like us, with virtually no budget and no employees, that's pretty good.
So just thank you to all of you who are listening, who obviously do hit on the website every so often.
And of course all of those who contribute in their various ways and degrees. But all of those of you who do listen, if you want to help us continue this project, continue to grow it and continue to support us financially, do please consider using our Amazon affiliate links, .co.uk.com in the US and .ca in Canada. Essentially, you buy anything, follow our links from the website to Amazon rather than just typing in Amazon, then anything you buy from winter clothing, Christmas gifts, to even, heaven forbid, religious studies texts, and we'll get a little percentage off the top at no extra cost to yourself.
Absolutely. And again, all of you who are out there listening, tell people about us, you know, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Google Plus, iTunes, and pass on the links to your friends and family and colleagues, and send them the Opportunities Digest when you see a job in there that might be suitable for one of your friends. You know, why not just send the whole digest? Yeah, and keep listening.
And don't forget to come back on Wednesday for the second part of our discussion on literature and religion. But until then,
everything is fiction.